Salutations and welcome into Let's Be Civil, Infotech's podcast with civil discussions on civil infrastructure. I'm Nate Binder, and here with me today is Chad Schaefer, our Assistant Vice President of Business Development and Sales and esteemed co-host. Chad, the last time we did an episode, I think we kind of time-stamped it by where we were in the college football season. I think the Spartans were on the verge of upsetting the Wolverines, and now they're paired up in the Peach Bowl with Pittsburgh. Some time has passed. How have you been?
I've been great. And yeah, they had an excellent season. Kenneth Walker should have got invited for the Heisman Trophy, but I'm happy with everything. And now just getting ready for the holidays.
Absolutely. As a fantasy football fan, I'm excited to see where Kenneth Walker ends up. So for those of you that haven't heard of Infotech, you can visit infotechinc.com to learn more about what we do. But in short, we provide a variety of construction administration and bidding solutions to folks in the horizontal infrastructure business. On today's pod, we're going to discuss a topic that's central to planning discussions across the infrastructure industry. I just got off a case study interview with a DOT centered around this topic, and that is cybersecurity. You can't go to a conference or crack open edition of ENR without some topic, some presentation, or factoid about cybersecurity being thrown into your face. And while it's not a new topic, as forms of attack and defense get more sophisticated, and as new technology introduces new vulnerabilities, it's becoming more important and more of a focus to leadership than rather than maybe something that was handled in the fringe by IT departments in the past. So, Chad, from your experience and your discussions with DOT leadership, are you seeing cybersecurity come up more frequently as a concern or a topic area?
Yeah, absolutely, Nate. I think cybersecurity is certainly one of the main focuses of not only departments of transportation, but really any business. As more technology moves to cloud or the SaaS, there's just continued questions on how best to manage that. And one thing I think is interesting, what your panel can talk about, is during the last podcast, you know, we talked a lot about the technology in construction and where the industry's going. But at that time, the infrastructure bill was pending. But as everyone knows, the infrastructure bill recently got passed, and there's actually some call-outs specifically in the infrastructure bill for cybersecurity, which I think is interesting because, you know, when you think of traditional infrastructure, you're thinking of roads, bridges, utilities, underground. And maybe I'll start, you know, with our panel because they're all experts in this area. What are some of your thoughts on what that could mean, you know, for the transportation industry, like with the increased funding available, where do you see some of the investments going to shore up cybersecurity practices, you know, maybe being more resilient and just in general in that area?
And before we, I'll have our panel introduce ourselves real quick, and then we'll get to that question. Welcome to Marty Provost, Ben Smith, and Doug Kuto. If you guys could take a moment to introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about your background, your mother's maiden name, and the street you grew up on.
Yeah, since you threw my name out first, I'll start. I'm Marty Provost. I'm the director of the hosting and technical services department at Infotech's Azure Products Division. I've been in the computer industry for 25 plus years. And I've worked with a lot of public facing systems. So security has always been a big part of my world. And my favorite password is password 123.
I'll go next. Hi, I'm Ben Smith. I'm a digital veteran from the ad agency for over 20 years. I'm a senior software engineer and architect with Infotech's ITI products division. And throughout my career, I've worked on a variety of different accounts, all of which required security or emphasis on that, many of which were HIPAA compliant. And that's where a lot of that, that stringency from my knowledge comes from.
Nice.
I'm Doug Kuto. I've been working computer communications for several decades now, first retiring from the Air Force and Intelligence Agency, where cyber was top of mind every day for us. Then as the CIO at Iowa in the state of Michigan DOT, and now as a consultant and senior fellow at the Center for Digital Government.
Awesome. Thank you guys for joining us today. And we'll throw it right back to Chad's question about where do you see those investment areas going into cybersecurity, both driven by EJIA and then just priorities in general?
I'll start again. So my perspective is the cloud. And what I'm hoping to see is more and more of the cloud first strategy at DOTs. Getting the cybersecurity responsibilities out of the DOT's responsibility out of their hands and putting it in, the experts, so to speak. And I think that the additional funds that are coming might get agencies to start really looking at a lot of their on-prem legacy systems and how they might replace those with cloud-based, likely SaaS offerings, where the security responsibility is, you know, on the vendor's side of the table, and in theory with more people that are experts in that realm. So I'm hoping for a lot more cloud migration, so to speak, for the DOTs.
Makes sense.
Yeah, at the center, we survey state and local governments. And we've seen for the last 3 years now, cybersecurity as the number one issue at all levels of government, hands down. But when you go to the next level and look at where they're spending money, it falls to the top five. So it's not the number one spending priority in all cases. And that's because of competing priorities that different levels of government have to address. With the infrastructure bill and cyber money going to those entities, I'm expecting them to shore up some of their cyber investments. We know that people have been the number one cause of ransomware attacks. And some agencies have seen the failure rate go from 20% to 2 or 3% by investing in training. In tools to test employees. That's a pretty simple implementation that an agency can take, both public and private. We're seeing spotty investments in products, infrastructure, securing the perimeter, particularly endpoint devices. And then the third area, in my mind, are the partnerships. Some of the recent ransomware attacks and issues the DOTs have faced were not attacks against the DOT directly, but were came in through a partner, like a tolling application that was outside the agency or some other application that they allowed into their systems. And once that became infected, so did the DOT.
Doug, I'd love to jump back to something you said earlier there. You mentioned that, you know, education is so important, and, you know, it makes sense that, you know, technology improves, we make a leap into a new technology and it introduces new vulnerabilities because maybe we don't understand all the ways that it could be vulnerable. And that's, you know, why cybersecurity is always a relevant topic, because the cyber aspect is always evolving, but people have mostly been the same for the past 20 years. So why is that training element so important? And what are some of the most like effective training programs that an institution can undergo or to make sure their people are up to speed and not inviting in potential risk?
Yeah. You want to create an awareness. Just, you know, we've spent a lot of money to reduce accidents and invested in safety. And those are people issues. And we're finding the same thing with cybersecurity. You want to create a workforce that becomes cyber aware in their thinking about cybersecurity so that they don't click on an email that's infected, which, by the way, is the primary way that folks do attack our agencies. They get an employee to click on an email. So there are training programs available that kind of test people, those that open bad emails, if you will, get to go to remedial training. It shouldn't be viewed as a punishment, but it's designed to create awareness. And what struck me as an IT executive is a reduction from 20% failure rates to 2 or 3 substantially improve your cyber posture, and you haven't had to spend any money on technology. You're working with people to make them more aware.
Yeah, I think those are great points, Doug. And Nate, to touch on something that you said, you know, humans have pretty much been the same way for several years. You know, we are creatures of habit. And so while a training or education is necessary, you know, hammering it in also is a large component to that too. Because we tend to forget when something's not in our sight or our view for quite some time. So making it something that becomes habitual is a necessary component. But then there's some things, though, that we're always just going to fall back on as humans: convenience. And those are areas where I think it's necessary to also have a framework or regulate certain softwares or the way that something goes about incorporating your passwords and making that something that's part of company policy so that there's no other way to get around it, to help prevent any of that human nature from also weakening that system.
As someone that's run into roadblocks here at Infotech, where we have, you know, very good internal security protocol, I agree 100% that there have been times I've gone to add, you know, a Chrome extension, for example, that I can't add. And I don't understand why I can't add it, but they know that, well, this is, you know, could have malware in it or whatever the, you know, particular risk is.
Correct.
Well, there's one thing that Marty mentioned that I think is important to elaborate on is, you know, Marty, you're talking about a cloud first policy. And in recent years, especially, we've seen really a tremendous amount of success with that attitude. But sometimes when you hear about cloud first, you know, policy, there's always some hesitation about data, you know, not being controlled within the agency. It's been on-prem, they have access to their data, they can use their data, archive it, manipulate it. Could you, or really, you know, you, Ben, or Doug, or anyone, just talk a little what it means for my data if it is in the cloud or somewhere else that's not, that where I'm not controlling it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that obviously is very dependent on the cloud service or provider that you're talking about. You know, what security controls and you know, guarantees do they provide? And so I gave a talk at IHEAP a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things was about SaaS. And one of the recommendations was that if you're going to go with a SaaS application or provider, a cloud provider, find out what their procedures are, what their security policies are. You know, do they do annual security audits? You know, do they do regular security scans? Do they encrypt their data at rest and in transit? You know, it's on you really to vet out your application or provider. And you know, that's kind of the key right there. And so if they're doing everything right, then it's great for you because you don't have to worry about it. They've got it all covered for you. But if they don't have great policies or controls in place, then that's, you should keep looking.
And to that point, Marty, you know, Infotech sponsors a report, the Civil Quarterly, that surveys engineering firms and contractors in the industry to pull some trends and insights out. And the most recent report was about cybersecurity. And of the companies surveyed, 60 to 85%, depending on 60, the smaller companies, and 85%, the larger companies, did not have an incident response playbook for cyber attacks when they occur. And maybe this is a more of a human psychology question, but why does it take something going wrong, or what's it going to take to have that additional level of preparation where recovery is almost, you know, just as important and response as protection?
Given Dud's history, probably has some thoughts on that one for sure, I imagine.
Yeah, incident response. In fact, I did a panel last week on that topic, incident response related to cyber. A couple of things go on. It's the IT versus OT within an organization. So sometimes that's viewed as the IT guys take care of the network, but many of the cloud applications are supporting operational needs. And the two really need to constantly work together and talk to maintain the security within the organization. One of the longer, and I say longer, 2007, the San Francisco Transit had a security incident, and they were prepared. They had a playbook. Their contractor was the source of that breach, but they had prepared for it. So they were prepared with press releases. The mayor was prepared to talk because all those things happen. When you have a incident, the press is going to pick up on it. The public wants to know the impact on service. In that particular case, it was interesting because the only system that was affected was the toll collection, fare collection. So they turned it off and they were able to run the trains. It happened to be Thanksgiving weekend. So the community thought the business district had paid for all the fares so people could do their holiday shopping. And they came back up on a Monday and were collecting fares again. But because they had a plan in place and had exercised it, they were able to respond and deal with it much quicker. And I'm seeing more and more emphasis on that planning incident response. Just like any other incident, we plan for weather events and outages, power outages, hurricanes, tornadoes, and we should plan for cyber outages.
Nate, I think you said you were inquiring as to why so few, though, potentially have some sort of incident response. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
So what I'd like to add, and I've seen this many times, and I think that this, I'd be reaching, but I think a lot of it goes into kind of how we perceive either our role or the company that we work for. You know, in a sense that we're a small company, it won't happen to us. Or what would anyone gain by getting our data? You know, it's a little bit of that hopefulness, too, that you're building something that people can utilize. And that's the success factor that you're focused on. Everyone wants to be successful, not a fail. And so I think it's not in one's nature to automatically think of all of the scenarios that could go wrong when you're working towards something that's a goal to go right. And it's only when you really have like a legal department, a data privacy officer, a security officer who knows of those things that could go wrong, who typically says we have to plan for these contingencies. So I really think a lot of it could be in just the human nature or the lack of an official who also has the ability to help steer that viewpoint or that vantage point. But it could also be just the size of the company or the type of company and the lack of knowledge as to how harmful any of that knowledge or PII information that could potentially be used elsewhere. So some of it's also just pure education. We're lacking the understanding that there's a financial possibility of the company either losing money for each person or record that is obtained from a database, or you know, any other type of catastrophic event that could occur to a company. You know, I think it's not at the forefront of anyone's thought while they're designing something.
Yeah, Ben, you're absolutely right about the planning in the forefront, but we already do within our transportation organizations disaster recovery plans for other kinds of events. So there is some process in place for how to handle outages caused by a hurricane, tornadoes, other events, population, and even an active shooter, which has become more common in our recent time. We just need to bring the technology folks into that planning process so we're planning for cyber outages as well.
Seems education and communication are kind of the two priorities there. I'm curious, we talked a little bit about how a hosting services provider can help ease the tensions of someone that's looking to have a system hosted. What about from the other side for vendors? Like if I go out and try and do that extension that I mentioned earlier and IT says, no, that this doesn't pass snuff. What can a vendor do for a software as a service product? Like we have, you know, for BitExpress, for example, to, you know, ease the concerns of maybe a more sophisticated company that does have those internal legal and IT departments that want to make sure that their third-party software is protected because it has some of their data in it.
Well, the steps that we take to protect data. First, a vendor, to just answer your question, I think they could request for more information, right? And seek an understanding, whether it's a checklist or just just how we handle any of that stuff that complies with any of their needs and regulations, which is something that we currently do. We field the questions that are asked, and we demonstrate how we take security seriously. Many of the things that we do to protect information ranges from, with cybersecurity, it's a wide array of area, right? Mm-hmm. So it could range from the training that we get internally, which was kind of something that we already discussed for phishing tactics and to ensure that we're not clicking on any emails without a little bit of consideration to who they're coming from, all the way to how we ensure that the data that we are keeping or safeguarding is encrypted, or ensuring that it's always transferred over SSL so that we know that it shouldn't be tampered with in the middle, the way that we ensure authentication or authorization of any request to information, how we set up the architecture for all of our applications. We don't just put everything in the public sector. We segment stuff from public and private so that we are well-equipped to only display what it is that we intend to be displayed when, you know, we're safeguarding any information, all the way to how we handle passwords or how you log in, whether or not we should be mindful of MFA factors, right? And should you just be allowed to put in a plain text? How do we handle storage of that information? It's almost too wide of a topic to be able to get into each of the areas. But we definitely have to be mindful. And to summarize what we can do is we look at tried and true tactics for development, and not just for development, but for architecture, such as OWASP Top 10. They'll cover off on all the areas of vulnerabilities or things that we need to be mindful of. And they continue to keep up to date with some of the leaders of the industry, with the top officials from Google and Microsoft. So, you know, it's coming from the same systems that all developers are tapping into, whether, you know, it's the Windows or it's Linux, or people who are also big data individuals. So staying up to date with those and ensuring that that gets put into practice and peer reviews. I could go on, and I'm sure that's not what we want to hear right now. But there's just so many different areas that you have to be mindful of. And we go through all of the different gambits of ensuring that we do so safely and confidently.
Yeah, Nate, the other trend I'm starting to see at local governments is more language being written into RFPs that require cyber compliance. They're just starting to learn how to do that. At the federal level, FedRAMP certifies products as cyber compliant. But looked at the software, the communication, that the application does everything it's supposed to do to be safe. What I see at local governments, though, including states, is a resistance to use federal regulations. And that's partly because of the way our government is structured. The states are somewhat independent of the federal agencies. But those same practices could be adopted in the purchasing process. There's also some help from NIST in terms of standards. In the Homeland Security folks are opening offices in each of the states. Transportation is one of the more critical economic areas identified. And because of that, there's support available. So that Homeland Security Office and CISA will help with assessments, writing plans, has a wealth of material available to state and local agencies that want to tighten up their cyber programs, particularly those without CISOs.
And NIST is the organization that lays out those cyber protocols?
Yeah, it's the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Marty, is that what the hosting department uses internally for the like the SOC Type 2 compliant levels that we try to achieve?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we use the NIST guidance to help define our policies and procedures. It makes it real easy. Like I don't have to, you know, figure out what I should do here or there. I can just lean on NIST, who's already spent tons and tons of research and time on what's right and what you should be doing, and just follow that, you know. excuse me. Yeah, and I think Ben touched on a lot of the like common sense or I guess standard cybersecurity strategies that every vendor and software provider should be following. You know, he mentioned multi-factor authentication. That truly is the single most effective protection you can deploy. I mean, it's not going to solve all of your problems, but it really takes a big chunk out of the vulnerability that you've got. He mentioned, I've already said it, data encryption, patches and updates. Man, there are so many exploits that you see on in the media or everywhere that if they had just been diligent about applying patches and updates, then it would have never been a problem. He talked about network segmentation. He mentioned public and private, but you know, that's network segmentation, you know, don't allow all communication between the two, you know, only specific sources and specific types of communication are allowed. So if somehow, you know, we'll use the DOTs, if your IT network was compromised, as long as you've got it segmented from your operational network, then you can still continue to have, you know, functioning system. I think we've kind of hinted about it several times here already, but to put it out to clearly, recoverability is, in my opinion, just as important as preventing a problem. If you do all your things you can to prevent an attack, it's all it takes, man, is one person to click on that bad email.
Yep.
And they're in. And so, you know, knowing that you cannot prevent all attacks is probably the best attitude to get, is, you know, be ready for if it does happen and make sure that you've got solid backups, you're testing your backups, you're just not hoping that they're working right and that you can recover from them. And especially important now is with ransomware is make sure that your backups are not vulnerable to attack. You know, make sure that they're separated out in some way, form or fashion, that if you do get compromised, that your backups are safe. So I think that's one thing that sometimes gets overlooked, is you got to make sure that you can recover and figure out, you know, what's it going to cost for you to be able to recover within an hour versus what's it going to cost if you can't recover for a week. You know, it could be a pretty big difference.
go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, well, one, I was going to say multi-factor is frustrating for me when my kids steal my phone and they're trying to log on to something. But besides that, you know, one thing we've discussed is the importance of education and training for employees. And, you know, Ben, Doug, Marty, all of you mentioned NIST, the top 10 list, and just there's a lot of educational material out there, you know, in this area. But is there's more attacks or, you know, continued changes and vulnerabilities with like open source code or ransomware, how dynamic is like the NIST guidelines or some of those top 10 lists out there? Like how does someone really stay involved and current with the ever-changing space in this area?
Well, my experience with the NIST standards and guidelines is that they are not specific enough to quickly become outdated, so to speak. It's more at a higher level, And then, so like when we're reviewing our compliance with one of the many categories of the NIST 800-53 spec, we have a security policy that is based on the NIST guidelines. But then more importantly, we have an implementation plan that is, how are we going to actually do these things? And that may mean incorporating, you know, an application firewall, or, you know, separate, you know, additional network segmentation or stuff like that. So I think it's the two combined is really important. And that's where you get into the details. And for it to be current, you have to have in your processes that you're reviewing your policies and implementations of those policies on a regular basis. Annually would be, you know, ideal, but certainly pretty frequent is important, because tech changes all the time. Absolutely.
So Doug had mentioned earlier kind of the difference between how organizations say they're prioritizing cybersecurity and what they're spending on cybersecurity. And I was just speaking to a DOT that was having issues going through the upgrade process for their enterprise system because they just didn't have the IT staff on hand to go through the upgrade process and everything that that involves. And they were also using a sort of third-party directory that allowed you know, third parties access to their systems, which was obviously a huge security vulnerability. So eventually they moved to our hosting services, and that allowed them to get up to snuff with the upgrade version, take care of all those patches, and then also use an external access system that would be a lot more secure for them. What is there a budget approach to cybersecurity that for these organizations that don't have robust IT departments, or is it just something that organizations really need to reassess their priorities if they don't have the team to handle you know, what needs to be done? And that can go to anyone that wants to answer.
They're still wrestling with that. I had a discussion with the director from the Maryland DOT a few years ago as part of a panel. And then he and I, in preparing for that, we talked a little bit. He knew that they were getting 8 million attacks to break into their systems every month. So he knew that number. That number is much higher when you go to statewide governments. Maryland was just the DOT. It's over 1 million a day in some states. There are that many attacks happening, we fend them off. So then I asked him about the spending question specifically, and he said he was spending $3 million. And I said, where'd you get the number? He said, I made it up. I didn't know what the number should be, but I knew zero wasn't enough, and I didn't know how much bigger that should be. So that set an item in his budget. And then he said, which is what DOTs do all the time, if something occurs, like a disaster, you've got to move money around anyway, they would reach into the program and make the adjustment to pay for whatever it took to recover, and then look at future investments. That is really rare that when I talk to executives just yet, they're not there, but that's where we want to get people. Then the other part of that, and I think Marty, you offer a good cloud solution. As a CIO, never had enough technical people. So I started to lean toward the cloud to take care of the back office, back end implementation. So I didn't have to worry. I could spend money paying people to maintain servers and databases and all those things that make them operate and they're necessary. Or I could spend my money on analysts, which I didn't have enough of, working with end users to get the benefit and value from the application. And so I kind of split the in-house staff on helping me and the direct access to the internal customer, and then let somebody like Marty provide a cloud solution and take care of the back-end infrastructure.
Yeah, the people constraints haven't gotten any better, Doug.
No, they're not. In the cyber arena, it's even worse. There's a shortage of over 300,000 cyber positions right now with no applicants available.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been hearing very recently, well, I've not nothing new, but DOTs continue to struggle with attracting new talent and keeping their talent for a variety of reasons. And the historically low unemployment rate is not helping.
I'm curious, how would either of you, Marty or Doug, if someone doesn't have a current budget allocated, what advice or tip would be able to be provided for how they can go about figuring that out? Would it be to first evaluate the organization and what type of practices they're making use of, or just based off of risk, coming up with a number for investment?
Yeah, the best system I've seen was implemented by Oakland County and just north of Detroit, where they took all the standards, the NIST standards, and went through that and did an internal assessment, whether they were compliant, whether they needed to work on a particular area. Mm-hmm. And they assigned a dollar value to the remediation. They, you know, and at that point, it's still an estimate till you get a project, but it's labor, material, can get you fairly close when you're doing a budget. Then they went through and prioritized based on the greatest risk. And they used that priority structure to then go to the county board of commissioners with a budget item and said, these are our top 5 or 10 items, and here's the cost to fix it for the county. And this is the number we need. That's the most rigorous process I've seen people do. The other is what I described in Maryland, where somebody picks a number and then figures out whether it was enough year to year and takes it up or down.
Right.
Marty, what's your experience?
I don't have any direct experience with that, but I think maybe the risk-based evaluation has some merit too, especially for a private organization where you can put some dollars to what it would mean if you were out of business for a day or a week or a month, you know, and then it would be kind of easy to say, well, we can certainly afford to pay, you know, that amount to prevent it from happening. So I don't know. I mean, I definitely see the risk-based approach is probably easier in the private sector because you can definitely align a specific dollar amount to the impact.
So I would love to touch on actually some specific industry examples of some of the things we've kind of mentioned generally throughout the podcast. Mainly, there was this ransomware attack on the Texas DOT in May of 2020, where a transportation vendor had a remote access Trojan installed on a company laptop, and then they accessed TxDOT through a VPN, essentially. It was well-planned. It was timely. It took them 4 hours to compromise the network using a vulnerability in Microsoft Office. Probably wasn't patched, probably wasn't up to date. What was kind of interesting to me here is their response. They had different steps for containment and recovery. And they really stressed, this is something you sort of touched on earlier, Marty, the importance of separating the response efforts and recovery efforts and response leads and recovery leads. What are some of the reasons to do that?
Well, they are two different efforts, right?
Yeah. Right.
the recovery is okay, well, how do we get back to where we were? And then the response is how do we stop it from getting worse? And or prevent it from reoccurring. And a lot of times, especially in a large organization like a DOT, those are going to be different people, right? Now, I mean, your security folks are going to be responsible for the response, so to speak. And then maybe your server admins, your data admins, those are going to be ones managing the recoverability aspect. You mentioned the Texas one, and that was interesting because it was a third party. Just as Doug mentioned, that's a growing vector that the bad actors out there are using to get to you. So it's like you've done your great due diligence to keep your kingdom safe, but you've got some for hire, people coming in, and you don't know how safe they are. And that's what happened here. And that's definitely a growing area of importance and talk. I mean, there's a lot going on that arena on how to make sure that the third parties that you're working with are doing their part to keep you secure.
Right. A lot harder to educate those third parties that aren't part of, you know, your internal training system. Yeah.
Well, that's where the purchasing and relationship management comes in. And then you've got to inspect your partners that are connected to you. Mm-hmm. Coming back to the Texas example, Nate, I had the opportunity to speak with the CISO in Texas about that attack. And one of the things that struck me that I think is important, TxDOT is a large organization. Their CISO was empowered to shut the department down once he knew there was an attack underway. He didn't have to spend 30 minutes getting approval and trying to track other decision makers down. 30 minutes when you're under attack, yeah, can really be devastating to an organization. And I'm not sure many people have given that a lot of thought. And that's where creating a response plan and says, who's going to do what and who's responsible. So he acted immediately. Then he did the notifications so that people understood what was going on and why he did it. But you want to stop this thing, an attack from spreading into your systems. The only way to do that is to turn the electricity off.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're really talking about here. And by the way, that's the most, the best way to be 100% secure is just don't ever turn anything out.
I just envisioned somebody in the server room unplugging all the cables from all the routers.
Yeah. Well, you know, but that was an important lesson for me, because I've seen other places where folks have to go get permission before they act. And that could be devastating in the situations we're talking about. And by the way, we do those same responses to weather incidents. There are things in place where there are people empowered to respond. And eventually you get the director, the deputies, the right folks engaged. But when you're talking about safety, life, saving activities, you don't want to have to go get permission to do what needs to be done.
And those third-party vulnerabilities, Marty, you were touching on something before we started recording about one that is in the news right now regarding Apache. Can you shed a little light on that story?
So we were talking earlier about third-party vendors or people, so to speak, but this hot off the presses vulnerability is a third-party application. So there's a vulnerability, a zero-day vulnerability just released for log 4j2. It's a Java-based logging functionality that's in a lot of things. It comes standard with the basic installation of Apache, among other things. And there was a vulnerability discovered that, cutting it short, is basically allows for elevated privileges on the servers that it's running on. And it's a pretty big one. And so everybody's scrambling to review their uses of this library and the version of it, because depending on the version, they're vulnerable or not vulnerable. Is where they have it deployed, is it externally reachable? You know, so if it's on an internal server that's segmented out from the outside network, you know, that's, you know, threat level 4. But if it's on, you know, a server that you can directly access from the internet, well, that's threat level 10. This is another example of sort of the global interconnected world that we're in, where your software by itself might be perfectly secure. But if you're incorporating a third-party utility or something of that nature, that can introduce a vulnerability. And in fact, Infotech has a group that's looking at that specifically for open source software. And I think we had a discussion earlier with some other folks about, you know, whether open source software is more secure or less secure. There's arguments on both sides of the fence there, because open source means everybody can see the code, so you know exactly how you might, you know, take advantage of that. And then the other end is, well, everybody knows the code, so they know how to prevent it from being vulnerable. But yeah, I mean, it's protecting yourself is not enough these days, is what it comes down to. Yeah, I don't know if Doug or Ben has anything to add on this recent Log4j2 vulnerability.
I know Ben mentioned it's impacting Minecraft, right?
That's where it was first discovered, yes. Yeah, the Minecraft servers that my son uses for his mods, he's got to be careful which one he connects to.
Yeah, so full transparency, before, like when we first went remote, I wasn't really sure what to do with my laptop, and I had Minecraft on it. Because, and then IT was like, hey, you can't have Minecraft on your on your work laptop. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. But say they had never caught that, and I had gone to play a game on Minecraft on my work laptop. Is that an instance of where they could have gotten into eventually Infotech systems?
Ben may be more familiar with the Minecraft aspect than I am. I believe it is only the servers that are up for the modded versions of Minecraft, but I'm a little detached from that. My son could probably tell you more than I could.
Yeah, I think you're correct on the servers to which that the actual game is hosted, but that does not defeat the fact that many people do their own hosting for the game.
Yeah.
And so if that was the scenario, then yes, people could have taken advantage. And I believe that's how the first case came around, was that someone used the command block, which is a component in Minecraft, and physically was able to take over the computer through Minecraft itself. And so, yes, if you had your own server running and not just taking advantage of a realm that's remote, then you could have been a target.
It really is interesting. You know, we're in the middle of this pandemic, how similar some of the language that we use to discuss cyber attacks. You know, the first case was here and they touched this person and then it led to these things. It really does spread the same, a very similar way.
They don't call them viruses for nothing.
Absolutely. I'd love to touch on one more real life example here about the Colorado DOT that Doug had forwarded to us earlier. It was a brute force attack that found one vulnerable server. And what was really interesting to me about this one is where the TxDOT example seemed like they had a very robust response and recovery plan. The Colorado, it didn't seem like it was as sophisticated. And they talked about, like, they went back to pencil and paper and had to set up like courier systems between departments to keep things running. And that was one of their takeaways, is like, have the, you know, the systems in place that are not electronic that you were maybe doing 20 years ago, because you may be completely without access to these systems. I thought it was a really good example of how far you can be set back in a matter of hours when one of these cyber attacks occur. I don't know if you have any other context to that story, Doug.
They were in the mindset of being hopeful that there'd never be attacks. They weren't thinking about that. So they were really caught flat-footed. Today, they've got those backup systems in place and processes. So hopefully, if you get your backups right, and yeah, and I've seen even with cloud strategy, organizations engage the cloud as their backup recovery solution. So they're operating on-premise for their daily operations, but if they're attacked, they're backed up. And they just move to the cloud and continue to operate. And until they turn on the cloud, they're not compromised.
Yeah, and I think that you really hit it on the head there in terms of the speed to detect and respond. If I'm not mistaken, I think Texas was much quicker in their identification of the attack and then response. So Colorado, unfortunately, there was more time for more things to get encrypted, essentially. And so they wound up with more of a mess on their hands because they didn't detect it quick enough or were able to respond fast enough. And obviously, they didn't have as much network segmentation as I'm sure they wish they had. And, you know, many factors go into that. And I don't know all the details on the brute force attack, but a lot of times when you see that where a system was compromised because of a password of brute force attack, nine times out of 10, it's because that was a default password for whatever application or system was using that, and they never changed it. I'm not saying that necessarily Colorado had here, but that's something really important to note, is that the minute you get something new and install it, if it has a default password of anything for anything, step one is go change those, you know?
Yeah, the case study I was looking at used the phrase admin login. So I wonder if that was like, you know, one of those admin one type password situations there.
Yeah.
We're seeing that vulnerability in our traffic management systems, because the end devices are traffic controllers and signals. And many people, even they're moving away from the number two keys, which you can buy for $12 on eBay. Which gets into any one of those boxes physically and into the network, is we've moved them to electronic, where there's keeping the factory installed admin password in place and not changing them. So yeah. Now we're adding the tools in that area that will automatically change the password as it's installed. Yeah, Nate, there's something else I'd like to mention before we run out of time. There is some help available to folks. There's a multi-state ISAC that does information sharing. Many public organizations belong to that, so they'll identify and share information about vulnerabilities and what people have done to recover and provide intelligence about potential attacks. The FBI has a program called InfraGuard, InfraGuard. And there are chapters all over the country. And they engage the private sector and the public sector and nonprofits in chapters. And they bring these folks together, and it provides the tie to the law enforcement community that will identify, again, intelligence. If you are attacked with a ransomware, they've been able to recover some of that ransom from the bad guys before they moved it out of bogus bank accounts. Mm-hmm. So the ARS resources available right down to the local level to the private companies and public companies that are working together. And again, transportation is just such a huge impact economically on our nation that it's an infrastructure we really want to protect and keep operating.
Thank you for sharing those. And, you know, you were talking earlier about hurricane response and tornado response and that kind of thing. I think it is also worth noting that Colorado did declare a state of national state emergency during this event. So they were treating it like a natural disaster and at the scale of impact that a natural disaster can have. As we wrap up this conversation, and again, I thank you guys for joining. Did you guys have any other closing thoughts?
I think just if anyone has a healthy fear of what is possible, you know, puts you at least in the position or the mentality to find the right solution, you know, or knowing that you need a solution. The IP addresses of IPv4, you know, are all known from zero to the highest IP that can be there. So knowing that you are accessible, you know, it makes you a target. And computers are going to be smart. And with the concept of providers such as Amazon or Google, I can spin up any number of machines doing my attack remotely for pennies on the dollar. Mm-hmm. So it's all possible. And I obviously want to have the widest net possible. So anyone, I'm going to knock on those doors, and so would anyone else. And recognizing that's possible, you know, is the start to, you know, knowing that you need to probably do something beyond what you're currently doing.
Yeah, I love that. A good sense of fear is important. I mean, I don't remember when the first time I saw it, but it was many years ago. The first time I saw a list of all the IP addresses that were scanning my public system in the last hour. That alone will wake you up to what it really, it's a wild west out there. I mean, it truly is. If you are on the internet, somebody's scanning you all the time looking for something, because it's easy. Because like Vince said, I mean, we know your address and we can just programmatically run through every single address on the internet looking for things that we know we as a, you know, third rate hacker can attack. you don't even have to be that sophisticated. There are so many tools out there that are readily available. So yeah, I think definitely a healthy dose of fear is important.
What I'm getting is it's a good thing you guys decided to use your powers for good in this situation. Chad, do you have any final thoughts before we get these guys out of here?
No, I mean, thank you, Doug, Marty, and Ben. I think it was a great discussion with a lot of key takeaways. And, you know, this is just, it's going to be a continued issue, right? As more people, it's advanced in technology, more move to the cloud, where just at a very high level, I think an important key takeaway is you need to educate your employees. You need to ultimately come up with a plan, not only to prevent a cyber attack, but also how do you recover from a cyber attack? And ultimately, someone needs to own that responsibility within your agency and have authority, you know, to make some split second decisions, because even if you have a plan in place and no one feels responsibility or ownership, it could be too late, you know, and seconds matter. So I agree with you, Nate. It's a good thing that we have some good guys on our side to help monitor this and protect our customers and ourselves.
Absolutely. And education is definitely the theme that I heard really at the highest level all the way down. It's very important. And hopefully this you found this podcast educational. So thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, let us know with a rating on Apple Podcasts, a friendly tweet, mailing us a nice note. You can find us at infotechinc.com/letsbecivil or at Infotech Inc. on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Our next episode is currently in the works, so if there's anything you want to hear about, chances are we have an expert on staff to talk about it. So just let us know. And then for Doug, Chad, Marty, Ben, and myself, until next time, keep it civil.